Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And so I was talking with my four-year-old son last night all about his earliest memories.
Yeah. Do you remember when you were born?
Yes.
What happened that day?
I was a baby.
Do you remember coming out of mommy?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
Is it possible that he actually remembers his birth? He certainly sounded confident there. How far does your memory go back?
Hi, this is Mike from San Antonio, Texas. I'm 36 now. I remember saying goodbye to my dad as he got into his old Ford Mustang to go to work. Then I would run to the other side of the house so I could wave again from the window. I'll always remember him waving twice.
Those first powerful memories, they're also incomplete, though, and they point up huge gaps in our memory of early childhood. Why do we hold on to some things and not others? Later this hour, some brain research that may have figured out how the librarian of our early childhood memories operates. Got any memories of the game Dungeons & Dragons? It turns 40 this month. We're going to get two grown-up boys to take us back to being elvish thieves down in the basement. It has been nearly 50 years, though, of brutal but often stable memories for the people of Syria, ruled over by one family for all of that time, the Assad family. Ba'athist President Hafez al-Assad and his son now Bashar al-Assad, Syria's current president. Hafez seized power in Syria in 1970, ruled that country with a tight fist, one-party, one-man rule. He moved quickly to crush political opposition, and in 1982, he carried out the brutal Hama massacre.
The resolution to this crisis cannot be about one man's insistence or one family's insistence about clinging to power. This needs to be about empowering all of the Syrian people.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry speaking in Switzerland, the site of the Geneva II talks on the latest crisis, resolving the war in Syria. Bente Scheller is director of the Heinrich Boll Foundation's Middle East office and author of The Wisdom of Syria's Waiting Game, Foreign Policy Under the Assads. She says that Bashar Assad's ability to evoke memories of brutality and extreme violence among Syrians makes it hard for the people to feel any kind of empowerment.
The thing is that there was always a kind of contract between the Syrian government and its people. And this contract included that most of the Syrians would just not step over any red line. They would not become politically active. They would not indulge in oppositional activities. And most of the Syrians, therefore, were guaranteed safety, security in their own country, and that they could make a basic living. And over the revolution, we've seen very quickly that Bashar al-Assad has dismantled this contract. There is no safety any longer, not even in the regime-held territories. People are safe any longer, and the economic situation for many Syrians has become extremely difficult. And therefore, I think now we see a greater opposition to the Syrian regime than we ever saw before.
But that said, when Bashar al-Assad speaks to the world, he often seems like someone completely out of touch. But when he speaks to his own people, it seems like they're getting a much different, more sobering message of the potential for brutality.
Oh, definitely. And there is such a big difference between what he tells people, both his own people as well as the world, and what they see in daily life. I mean, by now it has reached a level where pretty much everybody knows somebody who has disappeared or who has been killed. And still the government hasn't sent any message to the people that it will protect them in any instance, create safe zones, or provide them with essential needs. So therefore, for many Syrians, this gap between what they hear and what they see on official television and what is happening to them in their daily life is really, really huge.
The people of Syria, do they respond to evidence of torture and mass graves and the kind of video evidence that has come out from this defector by saying, oh, wow, this is a revelation to us? Or do they already suspect and really understand that this is going on?
I mean, for some people, of course, it is the same as on the international level. They claim it is not true, it is not happening, these images are forged. But there were really a lot of people who know of somebody personally who has been killed in this way. I mean, also, well, we are working here with a lot of Syrians, and among them we also had several cases where people just disappeared in prison, and we learned a few days later that they had been killed. So I think for many Syrians it's rather astonishing that now the world seems to react so strongly to these photos, because there was a lot of documentation of these crimes going on before, and also very reliable sources. So I think for those who were aware of what was happening, it is a bit of a surprise that the international community only now seems to notice at what scale the killing in Syria is going on.
Can you remind us what Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, did in the city of Hama in the 1980s, and how really that, for many in this generation, is the, you know, first memory that they have of what their government and this family is capable of?
Yeah, I mean, faced with a revolution back then, which was mostly Islamist-led, Hafez al-Assad chose just to send his tanks to the city of Hama and just erase the center of the city, basically. And people were arrested there in scores, people were killed. It's until now not really known how many people were killed in the act. It's estimations between 10,000 and 20,000. And back then already many people disappeared in prisons, and their whereabouts are unknown until today. So this is really something deeply set in the memory of many Syrians. But this is also one of the reasons why now Syrians are disappointed with the international reaction to what is going on now, because they said back then the world did not really know what was going on. But now we're transmitting images through YouTube and other channels, and still there is no reaction, even though it's well documented and it's not a secret. So therefore, this memory mixes with the actual experience of Syrians today, and it leads to a lot of disappointment with the international community.
Based on your understanding of Hafez al-Assad, what do you think Bashar al-Assad's notion is of his responsibility here as a member of this family? Why is he strengthened by everything that's happened here?
Because he takes part of the strategy that his father used. His father was just crushing dissent violently inside and trying to keep relations up with the world by just waiting. I mean, there were protests against some of his policies, but he always just waited until the storm weathered. And Bashar is trying to do the same. He's heavily clamping down on what's going on inside, and he's at the same time not giving in to any demands of the international level. So he's really trying to follow what his father did. It's just that his father never was faced with an internal and external crisis at the same time. So the situation is slightly different for him.
Bente Scheller is the author of The Wisdom of Syria's Waiting Game, Foreign Policy Under the Assads, and director of the Middle East Office at the Heinrich Boll Foundation in Beirut. Bente, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
One of the complications in the Geneva II talks is the fact that the opposition is divided over a mission to restore Syrian democracy, that's what the Free Syrian Army wants, versus a mission to establish an Islamic State from Lebanon to Iraq, which is what al-Qaeda wants, with the creation of the Islamic State in Syria. Contributor to PRI's The World, Maureen Alvezi, has been reporting from the region, and she says the Syrian opposition right now is facing a two-front war, one against Assad and the other amongst its own factions.
Well, what we've seen since early January is the start of the infighting between rebel groups. So on one end, you have the Free Syrian Army and other Islamic groups against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which is affiliated to al-Qaeda. And what's interesting is that ISIS has been very powerful for the past 5-6 months in northern Syria. And there's been some anger boiling over the past few months because they've led a campaign of executions, abductions against civilians, activists, journalists, against also rebel leaders of the Free Syrian Army themselves. And for civilians, it's been a very confusing situation. One man that I met at the border put it that way. Before, things were very simple. You had the regime bombing us and the Free Syrian Army trying to gain more ground. But now, with the recent infighting, you don't know who's who, who's where, and you certainly don't know who's winning.
Well, you know, for many people in Syria, for civilians, certainly for people who want to join the opposition in any way, they face a choice. Who do they go in with? And it's a life or death choice. Tell me about Abu Hussein, who really has viewed this entire process through the eyes of someone who used to work as a recruiter.
Well, yeah, Abu Hussein, he used to live in Ukraine, and he came back to Syria at the beginning of the revolution. And he was approached for a special mission, which was to facilitate the coming of the foreign jihadists who were landing in Istanbul and to bring them down to the Turkish-Syrian border. So he helped dozens of foreign jihadists come over to Syria. But then last spring, you had another al-Qaeda group that emerged, and that's the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And most of the foreign fighters left Jabhat al-Nusra, went to the Islamic State, and that's when Abu Hussein realized that he had really facilitated the coming of jihadists that were now turning into a problem.
Maureen, before we go, do you think people on the ground in Syria have a sense that these divisions and this stalemate between ISIS and the Free Syrian Army only strengthens the hand of Bashar al-Assad at the talks in Geneva?
The thing that comes back really talking to whether people from the FSA or regular civilians is that everybody has the feeling that the regime has played on the terrorist threat. It's really since the beginning of the revolution, Bashar al-Assad says that all the rebels are terrorists. But now you have actual terrorists. The FSA fighters, the civilians have talked to, they consider the Islamic State to be terrorists. And for them, this is something that was not existing, that was not there at the beginning of the revolution. And then these people have arrived and they've completely hijacked the revolution, but they've also made the case of Assad that the uprising at the end of the day is about terrorism. And so they're very angered about that. They're not putting a lot of hope or a lot of faith in the Geneva talk, to be fair. Like, a lot of them have long lost the hope that the international community was willing or able to solve this crisis. But what's interesting as well is that the Free Syrian Army, the priorities have completely changed. They have to tackle first the problem of the Islamic State, because as long as they will be there, they won't really be able to focus on taking down the regime.
Fighting amongst themselves and really a distraction from the main event, which if not the talks in Geneva, certainly the question of what will happen to Bashar al-Assad. The opposition may be not in a position to determine that, a position that could even be weakening. Maureen Olivezzi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Maureen Olivezzi is a freelance reporter and contributor to PRI's The World. Later this hour, we'll explore new research on how the brain stores childhood memories. And we're asking you, what are your earliest memories? And some of you in Portland love to tell this story. Here's a couple of voices. My daughter was an early talker. One day at about 2, she volunteered that she remembered her birth. I asked what she recalled, and she said it was dark and I was scared. Sounds like my son. Also from Portland, swimming with my mom, my little arms around her neck floating along while she swam. It was so relaxing. I felt safe, calm, and loved. I was 2 years old. The things kids say.
Hi, this is Kelly calling from Providence, Rhode Island, and the first memory that I have is of my parents putting my brother's crib together. We are about 14 months apart, and there was a fire in the fireplace, so it must have been winter, and he was born in the spring. So I think I was probably 12 or 13 months old.
That's an early one. New Jersey, I remember when I was about 3 being in awe of the fact that there was mud in our living room in the vicinity of the bay window. It had been left behind by a tornado, but I don't recall any broken glass. It seemed that it came in without explanation and had settled on the floor next to the wall underneath the window. That's a powerful first memory. From Seattle, Washington, first memory, my grandmother frying chicken in her Savannah kitchen. I was 4 or so. I recall the smells and the laughter. Smells are powerful memories. What's stored in your childhood archive? We'll talk about it. We want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The new brain research on childhood memory, that's coming up here on The Takeaway. For the long-term unemployed in an economy that seems to penalize people who have been out of the workforce for a long time, do long-term unemployment benefits have the effect of solidifying the situation in some way? Is there a spark that might move the unemployed to make a transition back into the labor market, a spark that is somehow extinguished by a steady unemployment check? Well, they're trying to answer that question in the state of North Carolina, where the state's unemployed are eligible for 20 weeks of benefits, down from 73, with reduced benefits as well. North Carolina led the way as the federal government at the end of last year allowed long-term unemployment benefits to expire for approximately 1.3 million Americans. Paul Tine is a North Carolina state representative. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you supported this reduction in benefits and the ending of unemployment benefits after 20 weeks when North Carolina put this into effect, right?
I did.
And Jaslyn Roberts, you're with us as well, right?
Yes, I am.
A Career Center Director for Charlotte Works, a job training organization. And when that happened in the legislature, you began to see changes in the kinds of people and the sorts of questions people were asking at your organization?
Yes, we did. We started to see a little bit of a spike in those who are coming in to get benefits or really to get assistance for help so that they can get back to work very quickly.
All right. Without blaming the unemployed for their issues and for what's going on with them, Paul Tine, is there a way to listen close to the ground and learn what the impact of this legislation has been in the economy for the long-term unemployed, Paul?
Well, sure. This is a ugly fix to an ugly problem. I'm not going to sit here and say that we got it absolutely perfect, but it's about trying to find the right balance where you give people the help they need to move from one job to the next while we also take care of a major problem, which was about $2.5 billion worth of debt.
What sorts of stories are you hearing of the impact this is having, either negative or positive?
Well, we're hearing about some people getting back to work faster, but we're also hearing about folks that are still struggling. I have a very rural area with high unemployment rates, and quite frankly, we don't have all the jobs out here that we need. So we really have to focus on building the economic environment that's going to help people get back to work by providing some jobs.
So, Jaslyn Roberts, how do you balance or negotiate or navigate this cruelty versus wake-up call issue? Because certain people are going to be just sort of dropped off the cliff here, while others are going to be motivated to take some real action.
Well, at Charlotte Works, we see a broad spectrum coming into the organization. Those that are newly unemployed, we also see the long-term unemployed and some of those who have received benefit cuts. We provide a large array of services so that individuals who may need skill enhancements can get the funding so that they can get back to work very quickly. It is a very supportive environment that includes workshops and also the opportunity to work with career coaches, because each person who comes in, they have a different story and they have different needs. So we focus on understanding what the individual's needs are, including looking at their background and experiences, and then create a customized roadmap so that that development can continue. Because everyone who does come in, their ultimate goal is to get back to work.
Are you seeing motivation as a result of these benefit cuts or desperation?
We see a combination of both. Again, it's because we have such an array of folks that are coming in. There are folks who come in who no longer have any benefits. So we do see a little bit of the desperation. We also see the motivation. And so we ensure that we can address both.
Can you help people? Have you been helping people?
Oh, we've had some really good successes. We get a lot of great testimonials from individuals who land after going through training through Charlotte Works, and also because it's such a supportive environment.
During the Clinton administration, the ending welfare as we know it was painful in the beginning. But in the end, people felt like, oh, well, it wasn't so bad and we're saving money. I'm wondering, Paul Tine, if there's a lesson here and if some of the cruelty of this decision is going to be overlooked as time goes on and forgotten, while only the successes will be pointed to.
Well, one of the things is that I think you're looking at it different than I did when I was trying to make my decision on this bill that's now law. Is I wasn't looking to penalize them or to say that they weren't moving fast enough. We had to create the right economic development or the right economic environment to grow jobs. And with $2.5 billion worth of debt, with the increases for the payback to the federal government, what if we hit another economic downturn? That significant debt was hurting our economic growth. And you need the jobs. You need the economic growth in order to be able to give a place for these people to go to other than what should be a short-term benefit to move people from one job to the next. So I don't look at it exactly the same way that you do, but I think we need to be able to grow the jobs, and this was an important piece of it.
But Representative Tine, if you can't grow those jobs, if the reduction in the debt doesn't deliver on this promise of economic growth, are you on the hook for constituents?
Sure. And I think we need to make some changes to the bill the way that it is right now. I ran some amendments on the floor that would have made it a little bit more moderate. It would have brought up the minimum payment to make it a little bit better. And I'm trying to adjust the weeks also, so that, because right now it's a trigger to a statewide unemployment number. We have some counties that are as, you know, low as 5%. We have some counties in double digits. And so, you know, one number across the state makes it very difficult for these different counties. So we need to make some changes. Like I said, this is an ugly fix to an ugly situation. We got in it together and we have to figure out how to get out of it.
Jaslyn Roberts, what would you say is the message from the economic situation in North Carolina to the rest of the nation beginning to grapple with some of these same issues?
Well, just from working with the individuals who come into Charlotte Works, being prepared for, you know, all eventualities, particularly having the experiences that you need to obtain employment and also to continue to have employment, to be long-term unemployed. We encourage our clients to look more for a career versus a job, which is also the reason why we provide the kind of services that we do.
Would you say this change in the benefit structure in North Carolina, Jaslyn, was a mistake? Or did it work out in your view?
Well, you know, our focus really is on the, you know, is on the consumer, on the client that comes in. And as you, you know, mentioned earlier, sometimes they do come in a little bit frustrated. And so what we try to do is really work with them through the frustration, you know, irregardless of the circumstances that they're in. Again, our focus is to help them get back to work.
Jaslyn Roberts is Career Center Director for Charlotte Works, a job training organization. And State Representative Paul Tyne is a Democrat from North Carolina's 6th District. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Let's talk about another economic experiment where consumers are the actual participants. Can you end chronic homelessness by simply giving the homeless homes? Sounds simple. This is what Utah set out to do in 2005, to end chronic homelessness within 10 years by providing each homeless person with an apartment and a social worker. 9 years later, how's it going? Whitney Evans reports on local government for Takeaway affiliate station KUER. Joins me now from Salt Lake City. Whitney, what are the numbers? How is it going?
Well, it seems to be going pretty well. As you mentioned, we are in the last year of this 10-year effort. So the Housing First method began in 2005, and since then, the chronically homeless population has declined by about 1,400 people. About half of those who leave the program end up finding a permanent place to live. Some might go to institutions or stay with family members, but it's only about 8% of those who actually go back to being homeless.
Would you say there's something demographically about Utah or the way that the state delivers services that makes this an easier problem than, say, trying to do it in the city of Chicago or Washington, D.C.?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure there really is. You know, the crux of this this program is providing this population with a low-cost apartment with very few strings attached. And I think that's the most important part of this program. Traditionally, these kinds of programs come with a lot of expectations. Tenants are required to be sober and, you know, sometimes employed, for example. But this model simply requires tenants to be good tenants and take care of their space and pay rent. So I'm not sure there really is a demographic reason for why this is working out so well here.
Well, you get rid of homelessness, you give someone a home. It's very, very simple. And really, as you discovered in speaking with Gordon Walker, who's director of Utah's Housing and Community Development Division, it's really all about looking at the problem in a different way. Listen.
It used to be that homeless individuals were asked to change their lives, and then they would be eligible for housing. And what we did is we said, hey, our problem is homelessness. Put people into housing. Then we provide them with help and support so that they can change their lives if they want to.
Does Gordon Walker believe that giving people homes and allowing them to have the experience of being good tenants, as you say, is a sort of gateway to other problem solving of social issues?
Well, absolutely. The housing, this low-cost housing that the state provides actually comes with a lot of on-site resources like substance abuse programs and employment services and even Head Start programs. The state is finding that many of these substance abuse and mental health issues improve sort of organically because these people have a safe, warm place to stay.
What about landlords and developers? Are they enthusiastic about the offering of this public housing?
You know, that's a good question. But as far as I know, this low cost housing here in the state is operated by the homeless shelter. So I think they're pretty familiar with the tenants and their situations.
So it's within the existing infrastructure for the homeless. It's
exactly.
It's just more like a real apartment and less like a shelter.
Yes, that's correct.
So your prediction is you're going to make it in 2015?
Well, it looks like it. We have fewer than 500 people in the state who are chronically homeless. But might I mention that, you know, these are the folks that are sort of regulars at the homeless shelters, those people who've been homeless for at least a year or experienced several collective months of homelessness in the span of 3 years. That population seems to be diminishing.
1,400 down, 500 to go. Whitney Evans is a reporter for Takeaway affiliate KUER in Salt Lake, Utah. The way you get rid of homelessness in Utah, give people apartments. Thanks, Whitney.
Thank you.
So what do half a billion Chinese people, the internet, and a two-story brick house in Cheyenne, Wyoming have in common? Only what is being described as one of the largest internet denial of service failures in history. An 8-hour outage this week that affected nearly every user in China involved maybe 75% of the domain name sites in that nation. Jason Ng is the author of Blocked on Weibo, What Gets Suppressed in China's Version of Twitter and Why. He's a research fellow at the University of Toronto-based Citizen Lab. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what happened in this outage and why was it so significant, first of all?
Yeah, it was pretty much a mystery to just about everyone. It sort of came out of nowhere. But essentially what happened was a giant malfunction of the Great Firewall. Essentially, when you plug in a web address or click on a link from within China, instead of going directly to looking up the IP address right away and then rerouting you to the website directly, oftentimes the Great Firewall will actually interfere in certain ways. And it looks like what happened here was that instead of interpreting and looking up the address for you, it sent all the traffic to various sites that it wasn't supposed to go to.
And when you talk about the Great Firewall, you're referring to China's very sophisticated technological attempt to control the internet by monitoring people's traffic. It sounds like it shot itself in the foot this week.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And clearly, as we've seen, the Great Firewall is incredibly sophisticated, but obviously, because it's such a behemoth, because it's run by so many individuals and so many agencies within China, it's very possible for things to go wrong.
And an 8-hour outage, at least in business terms in China, is going to have some significant dollar value attached to it, wouldn't you say, Jason?
That's absolutely right. I'm not certain if it was a full 8 hours, but certainly there was an hour and a half or 2 hours where there was just absolute chaos, and pretty much it was impossible to connect to any non.cn website. But yeah, for a company or a tech organization working in China that relies on the internet, it's going to make them think twice and shake their confidence. And I think, as we've seen from Chinese authorities and officials, anything that affects the economy is going to get their attention.
All right, now let's bring in the Wyoming connection here, because part of the forensics of an outage like this is trying to figure out what's going on and how various companies interact. And this Cheyenne, Wyoming address is basically a sort of symbolic paper headquarters of a company that was licensing domain names, and really underscores just how difficult it is to figure out what's going on when an outage like this happens.
Right. Yeah, I don't know how notable it is that it was sent all this traffic to Cheyenne, Wyoming. I don't think that's particularly interesting. It's just more notable is the fact that it was sent to these obscure locations, and it points to the fact that this was a total mess up on the part of the Great Firewall. Clearly, it wasn't meant to go into these places.
Is it a security breach, and is there something about the internet where businesses simply exist on paper that makes it difficult to figure out what's going on, or is this just how it works?
There has been speculation that it might have been a cyber attack. Obviously, from the Chinese standpoint, it makes sense to, if something malfunctions on your end, to try and spin it so that it does appear to be some outside external force that's causing you harm, clearly, as they've been able to scapegoat this sort of Falun Gong associated and other groups associated with being anti-China. So, honestly, it looks like an accidental mishap from where I stand, but the fact that the Internet is such a distributed, decentralized place makes it this sort of thing likely to happen again.
Finally, what's the lesson, do you think, for U.S. companies worried about cyber attacks in this sort of situation, that there's a limit to how much security you can actually do effectively?
I'm sorry?
What's the lesson for companies in the U.S. worried about cyber attacks?
From working with China, looking at China, it's clearly an issue where censorship causes issues, and any sort of interference that you cause to misdirect traffic or redirect traffic will cause issues.
Jason Ng is author of Blocked on Weibo, What Gets Suppressed on China's Version of Twitter and Why. He's a research fellow at the University of Toronto affiliated Citizen Lab. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
So you're in a crowd of strangers and you're feeling kind of like an outcast. What do I have in common with any of these people, you say? And then all of a sudden, you know.
Thank you out there. I want to say hi to any half-elf thieves.
Celebrity Stephen Colbert is actually your brother.
I hope all your attacks are +2.
Your Dungeons & Dragons half-elf brother. Just like Reggie Watts.
Is he dead or is he not dead? Is it negative 14? You're negative 14. Negative 14 is super, super definitely dead.
Watts and Colbert are D&D dudes, and it's not just bros who played this card adventure imagination game. Dame Judi Dench is in the family, along with Joss Whedon, Jack Black, well, that's obvious, and many others.
Any dungeon master worth his weight in geldings goes nowhere without his 20-sided die.
The game is 40 years old this month. Created by two obsessive gamers, it is still popular today. It's gone on to germinate a vast gaming culture that has given birth to the massively interactive adventure games of our time, games like World of Warcraft. Our next guests have done some half-elf thievery in their day. David Ewald is the author of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it. And John August is the screenwriter of Frankenweenie, The Corpse Bride, and Big Fish. August says that Dungeons & Dragons gave him permission as a little boy to activate his imagination. D&D turned it on, and the world-creating impulse of the game has been a part of his life and work ever since.
I think I got my first player's handbook when I was 10 years old, and I just remember sort of studying it like it was like a Talmudic artifact, like, you know, looking through all the charts and the swords and the spells. And me and my best two friends were playing Dungeons & Dragons all through junior high and high school. It was what we did. I remember Jason's dad would come down after we'd been playing all night. You know, he'd be making breakfast and he'd say, "Who won?" And, well, nobody wins D&D. It's just this ongoing thing. It's like a TV series that never ends.
David Ewald, actually the surest sign that someone has no idea what Dungeons & Dragons is if they ask that question, how do you win, right?
Yeah, it's a game that, because it's so different than Monopoly or any other kind of game you might play on a tabletop, a lot of people really don't understand it, and it can be a little bit hard to wrap your head around. This really is a game that's about imagination, unlike other games where you have a very specific set of directions. You know, go 6 spaces, pick up this card, do what it says. Dungeons & Dragons encourages you to use your imagination and make things up to tell a story. So it rewards creative thinking and creative behavior. It also struck at a time in the late 1970s and early 80s where a certain class of kids who were usually very nerdy or often very creative got super into the game, and then those were the people who went on to become screenwriters or directors or video game designers or all these creative class people who really got their first chops at telling a story by playing Dungeons & Dragons.
So, John August, is there a direct line from your basement and hanging out with Jason and the script for Frankenweenie, Corpse Bride, Big Fish, Charlie's Angels, and the rest of your work?
Absolutely. I think Dungeons & Dragons was sort of this crucial practice period for figuring out how you tell stories. And I think it's especially true for screenwriters because a novelist can sort of go off in a cabin and write his or her own novel and just be by themselves. Screenwriting is a social activity. You have to be able to tell the story with other people, and they have to participate in it with you. And Dungeons & Dragons is a very good proxy for what I was going to end up doing later on in life. I think you're going to find, if you surveyed a bunch of screenwriters, you're going to find a bunch of closet D&D players.
David Ewald, closeted D&D users, why was this a subculture in the sense that you weren't inclined necessarily to be completely open about D&D?
Well, one aspect was because it is sort of an inherently nerdy activity. You know, at some level, you're sitting around at a table with a bunch of other kids. You're not outside throwing a football. You're there rolling dice and doing math and talking about dragons. But I think really the bad reputation comes from a phenomenon in the early 80s where, because these rule books were out and in the hands of kids and they had pictures of demons on them and they had descriptions of spells in them, certain parents and teachers and ministers who didn't really know what the game was, they saw that and they panicked and they thought, this is satanic. What are our kids getting into? And so the game got this very undeserved reputation of, this is evil, this is wrong, this game is going to make your kid a deviant.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting to me about D&D is that, you know, unlike board games, there's lots of rules, but there's not an instruction set. In other words, you don't pull out the instructions and go, here's how to play. The rules sort of come out of the creativity of how players actually define the game as they go. What was the best element you came up with in your D&D universe? Something you're most proud of, a character, a set of powers?
I remember building this world, which was essentially this vast ocean of sand, and you had these sand ships that would sort of cross this great sea. And that was a chance to build this sort of impossible world. That's honestly, I think part of the reason why D&D is so appealing is because you can create these impossible worlds and sort of see together what is going to happen in them.
And David, does something you created that you're proud of?
It's so hard to pick because when you're so into this game, it becomes like war stories. You know, you're a veteran. You have all these moments you remember of, oh, remember the time when there were brigands in the house and we couldn't get them out. So we lit the roof on fire and reversed the gravity inside the house. So they got them that way. I mean, there's millions of these stories, and it's actually a hazard of the trade that when you sit down with another D&D player to try and get them to stop telling you about all the great times that they had at the table.
What happened to the creators of Dungeons & Dragons?
Well, the guys who are whose names are on the first edition of the game are two guys, Gary Gygax and David Arneson. They were both amateur gamers who, in their spare time, said, you know, let's build a system to play this game. They'd been war gamers before, the kind of games that you are simulating Napoleonic battles or a great fight in World War II. And they decided, well, let's do something with individual people. Instead of representing an army, I want to play a knight or one soldier. They created the game. It became quite popular. It sold really well, and the company making it in the late 70s and early 80s made millions of dollars. But these guys were amateurs. They were gamers. They weren't businessmen. The company very quickly ran into severe money problems. They racked up a ton of debt. They got sold. Throughout the history of the game, it's been sold twice now. The game is now owned by a giant multinational conglomerate. It's owned by Hasbro at this point.
And David, when you're in a group, what's the wink across the room that tells you that there's a fellow gamer in your midst?
You got to look for extremely nerdy in-jokes, people dropping phrases and words like critical hit or calling somebody a Monty Holler or a Munchkin. Probably physically, you know, maybe there's a certain a pale pallor from being at the table too far. But it's really about this sense of humor and about, you know, being part of this community and getting jokes that few other folks will.
David Ewald and John August, thanks so much.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
John August is the screenwriter behind Frankenweenie, The Corpse Bride, Big Fish, Charlie's Angels, many other blockbuster films. He's also a huge fan of D&D. And David Ewald is the author of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
All right, so think of your very first memory. Got it? Pretty vivid, right?
Hi, this is Andrew from Portland, Oregon. My earliest childhood memory is about being 2 years old, and I locked myself in the closet in my house to hide myself from the babysitter because my parents were out to dinner. and the sense of abandonment was just too overwhelming for me at the time.
Oh, poor Andrew in Portland. So here's a question. Why does his brain remember that experience, aside from the fact that it was pretty intense? And why is much of our childhood kind of wiped out, if you think about it? Can you remember your 7th birthday, 8th, 12th, 4th? Joining us to explain the curious science behind our childhood memories and how they're archived is Patricia Bauer, professor of psychology at Emory University, and the lead author of a study that really looks at this closely. Welcome to the program, Patricia.
Thank you.
So we've been asking people about their earliest memories, and we've been getting some very, very interesting responses. I spoke actually to my 4-year-old last night, and I want to play the memory he claims is his first. But before I do that, what's the brain doing when it selects a first memory, do you think?
Well, that's a very complicated question, and I wish I had a succinct answer to it. The brain is gathering bits and pieces of information that were encoded at the time of the experience. So we sometimes think about memory as a file folder that you simply open up and you read off the contents of the file folder. But really what it is a very distributed representation, distributed across the entire cortex. And to retrieve a memory, what you have to do is recreate the pattern of activation that actually corresponded to the original experience.
Mm. All right, so I sat my 4-year-old down last night, his name is Ajax, and asked him a question. Listen to this little interaction here. All right, what is the first thing you remember in your life?
The first thing I remember is my life when you were watching the Super Bowl, and all the kids were watching the Super Bowl, and I bumped my head in the corner of the wall.
So you were watching the Super Bowl and you bumped your head?
No. You guys were watching the Super Bowl. I was not.
And then what happened?
I had to go to the hospital.
What did they do with your head?
They got me a shot, but I'm not scared of shots anymore.
That's good. Thank you for that story. So, Patricia, he's not scared of shots anymore.
That's an important development.
Yeah, you got that story, right?
Yes, I did.
All right. Now, here's the fascinating piece. We weren't watching the Super Bowl. What we were watching was the returns for Obama's reelection in 2012. But we were gathered in the bed in the exact same way in front of the TV as we would have been for the Super Bowl. So he's already kind of mixed two memories there as a 4-year-old.
Yes, and actually that is very illustrative of one of the differences between children's memories and adults' memories. So one of the things that adults do when we're encoding an experience, we tend to give it a specific time and place tag, as it were. It was the time that we were watching the Super Bowl. We were in the bed in our house in which we lived 2 years ago, etc. We give it a time and place tag that is one of the things that helps us retrieve that memory later on. Those tags tend to be something that children routinely omit from their memories. So it's easy then, therefore, for them to confuse when and where an event took place. And you can see how that would lead to later memory confusion if you can't identify the unique location or timing of an event.
Although he's so confident. I love that. And here, listen to this memory from a Phoenix, Arizona listener. When I was 2, my soon-to-be divorced parents had a fight. I checked with my dad, then walked out to the porch to comfort mom. Can you remember what went on when you were 2?
Well, there are enormous individual differences. The average age at which people identify their first memory, their earliest memory, is somewhere between 3 and 3.5. But within any group of adults, you have very large individual differences. So some adults will have memories from as early as the 2nd year of life. And others will say that their first memory isn't until they were 6 or 7 or even 8 years of age.
All right. Here's another one of our listeners who responded to the question, what's your earliest memory?
Hi, this is Thomas. I'm from Abington, Pennsylvania. My first childhood memory was a raging case of chickenpox when I was 2 years old. I had them so bad I couldn't walk. It sucked.
Now, that's a common memory, I would think, of your first chickenpox or measles, something like that.
Well, one of the things that's common is the trauma, and I'm putting scare quotes around the word trauma, but earliest memories tend to be affectively charged, either positively or negatively. So when you've had something that is very uncomfortable, scary in the case of an illness or bumping your head and having to go to the hospital, that tends to be something that is characteristic of people's earliest memories.
What is the brain doing by not remembering so much of childhood?
The neural structures that are responsible for forming memories are developing enormously postnatally throughout the first two decades of life, but certainly very heavily a lot of development in the first decade of life. So you have brain structures that are doing their job, but they're not doing their job very well. So you don't have the efficiency, and therefore you don't have the efficacy that we as adults have when we form memories.
Do you think there's actually a subroutine in the brain called childhood amnesia that is basically uploaded at about age 7?
I don't think that's what happens, actually. What I think is a much more organic process, that over the course of childhood, we're certainly forming memories, but we're also forgetting those memories at a more rapid pace than we forget them as adults. So although the structures are moving and functioning in a way that's very similar to adults, it's just not as effective or efficient. So I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that we have something that comes in and kind of undoes early memories or radically changes the way memory works.
But your research does show that there's a real turning point at about age 7.
Indeed, it does. So we interviewed a number of children. Many children had conversations with their mothers or fathers when they were 3 years of age. And then we invited them back into the laboratory at different points thereafter, so either 2 years later or as many as 6 years later. And what we found is that the children who came back when they were 5, 6, or 7, they had very good memories for the events that had happened at the age of 3. They remembered a lot of the events. In contrast, the children who came back when they were 8 or 9 years of age had forgotten most of the early events. So that age 7 seems to be kind of an inflection point that we see in the distribution of memories across our lifespan.
I gather you've thought about this a little bit. What's your earliest childhood memory?
My earliest childhood memory is pretty characteristic. It is of an emotional event. We had moved into a new house, and I was riding my tricycle on the patio, and I fell off the patio.
Oh.
So it was traumatic.
You got a boo-boo, right?
I did indeed.
Patricia Bauer is professor of psychology at Emory University, lead author on this study of what happens in the brain where we preserve and also lose our childhood memories. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So here's a powerful first memory from Connecticut. I remember sitting in my mother's lap just months before she passed away watching the movie Homeward Bound. We were both crying. Listener from Tallahassee, Florida. I was 3. My big brother was taking the bus to his first day of kindergarten. I was so upset he was leaving, I chased the bus naked about a block before my mom could stop me. Happy first day of school, Chris. Well, tell us about your very first memory at 8778MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway if you want to check up on that conversation, see my son Ajax. You can go to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.